Welcome back, y'all, to episode number 11 of the Wildly Unexplained podcast. I'm Gary.
And I'm Danny. What's up, bro?
Not too much, my man. So this week we got a really interesting case, actually, taking place in Massachusetts. Do you want to give a little bit of insight?
So episode 9, we covered the smiley face killer theory, as you recall, about the investigation of Kevin Gannon and Anthony Duarte, retired detectives from New York City. And, you know, their theory is kind of basically about college-age men who were found in bodies of water, drowned, and authorities pretty much dismiss them as accidental drownings. But they believe it's actually a conspiracy or a group of killers that's pinpointing, tracking these people down, and actually murdering them. And last week, we went into the case of Luke Holman, and, you know, we covered some of those details of that case. And we went into the very detailed book that was written by Gannon and Dr. Gilbertson, the case studies in drowning forensics.
Yeah, and have you actually, like, have you taken a look into that? Because I've actually, like, you know, kind of in between breaks and everything like that, kind of been reading a little bit more into it, and wow.
Yeah, no, I've gone into the book. I definitely know a little bit more about drowning forensics than I did when we started this. It's a very interesting book, and you know, if you're interested in these cases, that's definitely a very good starting point. You know, they detail a bunch of cases that were labeled as accidental drownings, but man, when you look at the evidence that they point out, I can't see it how the authorities didn't look deeper into some of these cases.
Yeah, it is pretty bizarre. You know, when you do really kind of look into some of the more, you know, into the nitty gritty details of that particular case, you know, it just really kind of seems like they just kind of turned a blind eye, you know, in certain facets of the investigation. And
yeah,
you know, like, honestly, you know, I know that we had kind of, you know, went back and forth on this last episode, but, you know, it was annoying, one, you know, because you want to be like, you know, that's our, you know, I mean, I bleed blue, you know, I love our police force, and I love what they do. I love, you know, I fully support them, but it's like hearing stories like that, it's just kind of like, wow, like, why?
Yeah, I understand completely what you're saying. And like you said, it was a little frustrating because when you see, you know, the dogs that were involved in the case, that, you know, they signaled there was something going on. The weird thing about the band that was there last night where, you know, remains of a cadaver were, you know, might have possibly been in that back seat. The scent of Luke being in the back seat as well, you know, the lack of follow through, the fact that they let him go, they didn't take the van for further forensics, that was a little weird. You know, the fact that they didn't investigate the phone records, you know, the location of the phone, there were a lot of question marks in that case, and, you know, a lot of points that I believe they missed.
Yeah, and again, I mean, like we kind of, you know, kind of keep saying, you know, it was very frustrating, you know, to kind of be on this side of things, you know, kind of looking into all these facts and all these reported facts as well, you know, that were documented by these two investigators. You know, it's just kind of one of those things where it just really makes you wonder, you know, and wonder if there was, you know, knowledge of what exactly happened to, you know, to Luke Holman. I mean, you know, and if they're just trying to keep, you know, keep kind of quiet, you know, about obviously what did happen and why it keeps happening.
Yeah. And this week, I want to talk about another case that it was, you know, I don't want to give away too many details, but it was labeled as an undetermined drowning. I'm sorry. And some of the details of the case really didn't add up with me. And this week, we wanted to talk about the case of William Hurley. This case kind of leaves you contemplating what happened on that night he disappeared. It very much fits the profile that were established by Gannon and Duarte. Like I said, almost all these victims are white, college-age males who are described as athletic, good-looking, and academically successful. And I believe Luke William Hurley fit that profile.
Yeah, no, he absolutely did. And, you know, the circumstances that, you know, that unfortunately happened, you know, in this particular case that we're going to dive into very shortly here, you know, it's just one of those ones that leaves you scratching your head.
Yeah, so, I mean, let's get a little bit of detail. Like we said originally when we started doing this theory, the smiley face killer theory, we wanted to get into some of these cases and kind of learn more about some of these young men that had their lives taken from them a little too early. And, you know, William was, he was no exception. You know, he was a stand-up guy. He was a 24-year-old Navy veteran from North Carolina, but he was actually stationed in Florida at the time. He was 5'8 and weighed 155 pounds. So obviously that fits some of our criteria. And in March of 2007, Will visited Boston for St. Patrick's Day while he was an active duty sailor. And this is where he met his girlfriend, Claire Mahoney. You know, they developed kind of an instant connection to one another. They exchanged phone numbers before Will ultimately returned to Florida. And, you know, they maintained a constant communication with each other. And ultimately, this resulted in Will moving up to Quincy, Massachusetts to live with her in December of that year of 2007.
Mm-hmm. So Will and Claire were actually discussing the possibility of getting married, but they decided at that point to hold off until they both had kind of saved up a little bit more money, you know, which is definitely understandable. That's a
weddings are expensive.
Massive undertaking. Absolutely.
Yeah.
So Will actually found a job as a greenskeeper at the Weston Golf Club, and Claire had actually graduated from Emmanuel College and was studying for a master's degree in teaching, and that was going to be at the University of Massachusetts at Boston.
Mm-hmm. And Claire actually, you know, after this whole case happened, she was interviewed, and Claire described Will as a happy, easygoing, and kind of a fun-spirited person. And, you know, Claire said that he made her a better person. You know, he was very, you know, very fun. He liked to do things, and she very much felt alive when she was around him. And his friend Brendan Venti described Will as a very responsible guy, the kind of person who was never late to work. And he added that Will was a quiet dude with a dry sense of humor.
So on Thursday, October 8th, 2009, Will was actually invited by one of his friends and coworkers, Brendan, who we actually just mentioned, to accompany him to see a Boston Bruins game. So Will was relatively new to the Mass area, and he wasn't necessarily, you know, a big hockey fan, but, you know, he just kind of said, all right, you know, I'm going to go, you know, hang out with my buddy and, you know, have a good time. You know, and actually at that point, he actually contemplated, you know, if he even was even going to go, you know, to see the Bruins.
Yeah, he was pretty tired from work that day. And like you said, he wasn't a big hockey fan. He wasn't a Bruins fan. But, you know, first time going to the TD Garden, might as well, you know, go and enjoy it.
Yeah, I mean, like, that's an experience in itself. I mean, you know, just going to a hockey, you know, any hockey game, you know, in any arena is going to be an experience.
Right.
So after he got off work, he took the train from Quincy to Brighton, and that's actually where Brendan's home was located. From there, the two men actually boarded public transportation with another gentleman. The man's identity actually was never disclosed, but he was a friend of Brendan's. So that's kind of a weird thing in the facts here, but moving on. 20 minutes later, depending on the traffic, they actually arrive at TD Bank North Gardens in Boston to catch the game.
Right. And, you know, they showed up to the game, they got drinks, and they started watching the game. So after the first period, Will stated that he was too tired to stay, and he decided to head home for the evening. You know, perhaps we got to look at the fact that he did work as a groundskeeper at a golf club, and, you know, maybe it caught up to him. You know, the long day at work, he would usually get up around 4:30 a.m. to get to work. And this was already at night. And, you know, coupled with the fact that he wasn't a Bruins fan, he didn't really understand the game that well. I mean, he was already there for one period. And Will supposedly was texting his girlfriend, Claire, throughout most of the game when he was there. And he actually mentioned that he didn't really like the guy he was sitting next to. You know, maybe this person made Will upset, and that's why ultimately he decided to leave the game early, but after only the first period?
Yeah, I mean, it's a possibility at this point. Yeah. So Will walked out, you know, he walks out of the game, calls Claire to come pick him up. Claire was actually attending University of Mass at Boston, which is roughly 20 minutes from the Garden, so she wasn't very far away. You know, so according to Claire, she was only a couple of blocks away when she called Will on his cell phone to figure out exactly where he was so that obviously she could grab him. So Will, who was not familiar with the area, could be audibly heard asking someone where he was located. So a man was actually heard replying, 99 Nashua Street. Originally, Will told Claire that he was in front of the Garden, where she pulled up, but she didn't see him. Having no place to park, she slowly kept driving around the stadium to try and find him. So, I mean, that kind of, you know, brings the head here. You know, why did Will walk to Nashua Street if their plan was to meet in front of the Garden? I mean,
right, because if you look at the map.
Yes, and sorry to cut you off here, but, like, ultimately, like, you can tell, like, where the front of an arena is.
Yeah, definitely. And that was a little peculiar about it because he had told her he was in front of the garden. And when you look at the map, 99 Nashua Street is right behind. So I wonder why he started walking towards the back of the arena. That part, I wasn't really sure why he did that.
Yeah, I mean, it's just very peculiar because, again, like, I mean, even, going to any other local stadium, I mean, you can typically pick out, where the front of it is, even
You're
without
right.
having a map. I mean, just by, I guess, using common sense at this point, you can pretty much know.
Yeah, it's interesting. I mean, maybe he had a reason, maybe he didn't. I don't know, maybe you can figure out a more reasonable explanation. The more we get into the details, the more get into more of the weeds of this case.
Yeah, for sure. So at this point of the game, Will told Claire that his phone was actually about to die. Claire drove to the location Will had told her, but it wasn't there when she arrived, and which was only a couple minutes after getting off the phone. So she called his phone a second time, but it went straight to voicemail, which actually indicates to us that the battery was dead at this point.
Right. So, Claire drove to 99 Nashua Street as the person can be heard audibly on the phone. She got out of the car looking for Will. She even walked around the parking lot because if you look up 99 Nashua Street, this is basically a parking garage right behind the arena. So she got out, started looking for him. She yelled his name. He's nowhere to be seen though. And like you mentioned, she was only a couple blocks away at the last time she talked to him. So more than a few minutes couldn't have gone by before she actually reached the area that he told her he was at. So she looked around, worried and upset. She headed back to her apartment, Quincy, and waited anxiously for Will to return home. So maybe he grabbed a cab or he decided to head home by himself, which is a little odd, but maybe because his phone died, he thought that might be a better idea. I don't know. It's hard to explain that.
I mean, just kind of thinking from like personal experience. I mean, my phone hasn't necessarily died a whole lot while I've been out, but if it ever has died when I've been out, like I've definitely tried to find an alternative way home. But if I had said to somebody that, hey, I'll meet you here, but my phone is going to die, then I would probably just stay in that spot,
Yeah,
because at
you.
that point of the game, you don't want those people to necessarily worry where you are, or that in this case that he just goes missing.
Yeah, that would make more sense, obviously. If you told the person where you were at, you would stay put until they'd find you. You'd find some alternative way to get in touch with them. But I mean, she obviously was worried about him. She said she looked for him for a long time. She walked around that entire area yelling his name, but she could not locate him. So, I mean, obviously she decided to head home. Maybe she thought that was a better idea. Just wait for him to get there because maybe he took an alternative way back there.
Yeah, so some time passes here, so she decides to call Will's friends, the hospital to try to locate him, maybe see if he, checked himself in. Nothing turns up. So when it was apparent that it was too late and Will had not made it home, Claire actually calls both the Quincy and Boston police departments to file a missing persons report. Both precincts advised her that she needed to wait the standard 24 hours before filing a missing persons report.
Yeah, which is frustrating, but I mean, you hear that a lot, and it's pretty much standard procedure. But with somebody like that, that's a mysterious circumstance. Because obviously, this was hours after the game, where he should have been home. So Claire felt that there was obviously something wrong with Will, but she was powerless because she couldn't report him missing so early. She had to wait a full day before she was able to, bring this up to the authorities.
Yeah, and that's one of the things too, where I understand that like that they don't want to be inundated with paperwork or having to having to deal with people who go quote unquote missing, but I feel like there should be some sense of urgency. If someone's like, listen, this like I have not seen this person. I spoke to them on the phone. Their phone died. They were not in the spot that they said they were going to be. There has to be some sort of, some sense of urgency, I guess is what I'm getting at, for some particular case like that, instead of just being like, no, sorry, you gotta wait the typical 24 hours, before you can actually, file this report.
Yeah, and I completely understand what you're saying. And I also try to look at it from the police station standpoint. Obviously, I'm sure they get a ton of missing persons report. It still sucks that you got to wait a whole day because at that point, as you know very well, that in a missing persons case, every minute is crucial. And
Oh,
when you already
absolutely.
have to give it 24 hours, there's a lot that can be lost during that time. So
Well, I
it's
mean, look
frustrating.
at the TV show, The First 48.
Yeah, definitely.
Prime example right there. I mean, they typically say you've got 48 hours to essentially find that person before something not great happens.
Yeah, and if you look at some of the cases we've covered in the past, if the search effort began much earlier, it might have been possible that these people could have been found, before they ultimately, resulted in dying or never being found again. So definitely sucks that she had to wait 24 hours, but it is what it is. But the following day, on that Friday, with Will still not turning up, she filed a report at both of the stations. So that day, Claire got together with her sister Katie, and they began hanging up flyers around the TD Garden and around the surrounding areas. Obviously, trying to give themselves the best shot at finding Will. So according to Claire, Will's friends and his family, his disappearance was extremely out of character. What could have possibly happened to Will, a guy who was as responsible as he was, who never missed work? Now, they were hoping for the best, but they suspected something was terribly wrong here. It didn't sit right with any of them.
Yeah, so I mean, in the meantime, with all this happening, Boston PD actually is launching their investigation into, Will's disappearance. So Boston Police spokesman Joe Zanoli actually released a statement, and I quote, "There is no indication of foul play at this time. However, that doesn't mean it necessarily hasn't happened. We just don't know. At this point of the investigation, it appears he just vanished. Whether that was on his own accord or not has yet to be determined."
Yeah. And during this time, Will's case was on all the major news cycle, detailing like the bizarre circumstances of his disappearance. So, he was on CNN, on Fox, on MSNBC. They were covering the story. It was a little weird. And a string of drownings had already kind of plagued the area for a while now. So it wasn't the first time that they were seeing this. So, I mean, it's interesting that his case, kind of got national coverage. So Will's mom, Lynn Martin, she arrived from North Carolina the following Monday. She and Claire set out to speak people in the area where Will had gone missing. And Claire said, I quote, "We've been talking to people in the area, transit cops, barkeepers, and anybody who have been around, even homeless people who may have seen something, but there was nothing, absolutely nothing," end quote. It's pretty frustrating. They weren't able to get any information on Will's last known whereabouts. Considering how busy of an area this is, around the arena, especially on game night, wouldn't you say, Gary?
Yeah, no, I absolutely would. I mean, but granted, you have to think about this. So if he left after the first period, people are gonna be, in the halls, getting beers, getting snacks, getting food, whatever. So if he's gonna be outside, I mean, once the game kind of starts, I mean, it's not necessarily like it's a ghost town, but it's not, they're not gonna have as much people around. So that's definitely something that I want to notate, first and foremost before, we start going back and forth about that. Just because of the fact, I mean, maybe there wasn't a heck of a lot of people around, at that point of time during the game.
No, you're right. And also the fact that he wasn't at the front of the stadium where most of the traffic would have been, he walked towards the back of the arena. So, obviously mid-game, maybe there's not that many people walking around the back part of that area, but it's interesting that nobody came forth that saw Will that night. There was no eyewitness that saw him besides one person, which we'll get into in a second here. So
Yeah,
on
and I
that.
mean, just a quick pause for a second. I mean, and it's not even the fact of the matter that, TD Garden is in like a desolate area. Like it's in a really up and a really uppity neighborhood. It's not a quiet place to go. Massachusetts is not a small city, for instance. Like it's not
Yeah, you mean
something
Boston.
where, yeah, exactly.
Not Massachusetts. But yeah, I get what you're saying. Boston, it's a pretty jam-packed city, and this is at the arena. But I get what you're saying. It's in the middle of the game, so there might not have been a whole lot going on, especially in the back of the arena.
But more so what I'm getting at is I'm kind of playing devil's advocate, kind of playing both sides of the field here. You know, where yes, it was first period, you know, so a majority of the folks that are around the area of TD Arena are going to be watching the game. You know, and or getting snacks, refilling, bathroom breaks, whatever. You know, on the outside, if he's going to the back of the arena or whatever, wherever he was, to the side or, you know, not to the front of the arena, you know, because some people do actually arrive late to some of these games. You know, they figure, ah, we can miss the first period. No big deal. You know, but they would be going to the front of the arena,
Yeah, that
you
makes
know?
sense. And I mean, like I said, the parking garage was behind, but there might not have been a whole lot of people. And behind the arena, I tried to find more information on it. And supposedly, you know, the back of the TD Garden, it's kind of sketchy, the area. So I mean, obviously that's all anecdotal. There's no way to corroborate that, but that's what I got. You know, it's a little sketchy, that back area. Not a whole lot of people like to go, you know, frequent that area unless you're from there.
Yeah, so on the same Monday, Boston PD actually searched the immediate area of the stadium and put two boats on the Charles River to search the water near the Spalding Rehabilitation Hospital, located on Nashua Street, possibly looking for a body and following the flow of the river. So police actually said, and I quote, "They have found some things of interest, but nothing concrete." So despite this, after the search around TD Garden and around the water, they had no hard or definitive evidence to report. Apparently, it was reported that Will's phone was found near his last known location, but it was no longer in working condition. No more info about the phone came out during this time of the investigation.
Yeah, they didn't bring forth any more of that information. They were kind of vague on the phone situation, you know, but they obviously suspected some that he might have potentially been in the water because, you know, like you said, that same Monday they had put two boats in there and they were following the flow of the current, trying to see if they could find something. And the phone, you know, they didn't bring that up to his family, and they didn't release any more information on that. And throughout their investigation, you know, they figured out that the man who was audibly heard telling Will he was on 99 Nashua Street, he was identified as a security guard working in the parking garage outside of TD Garden. So he was interviewed by police, but he ultimately did not have much valuable information for the investigation, and you know, he was let go for no more further questioning.
Right. So unfortunately, 6 days after Will goes missing, his body was actually found upstream in the Charles River at about 2:30 a.m. near the Nashua Street Jail by Boston PD on a routine patrol, not far from where he asked his girlfriend Claire to pick him up. It's roughly about a 5-minute walk from that point. So a water forensics team was actually called to recover the body, which was 25 feet from the shore around 200 Nashua Street. North Point Park, which is the state park there, is directly across the river from that location.
And you know, when they found them, Suffolk district attorney spokesman Jake Wark said that the body was in the water a couple of days. Police ruled out a robbery as they found Will's keys and wallet on his person during the recovery. This is how they made a possible idea of Will's body at the time. It was indicative that police were beginning to rule out foul play at that point because of the wallet. So why would District Attorney Jake Wark say that Will's body was in the water just a couple of days when he was missing for 6 days at that point? Did he make a mistake in the press conference? And if it wasn't a mistake, how did that not raise massive red flags in their investigation?
Yeah. And so another Suffolk District Attorney, Daniel Connolly, went on to say, quote, "There are no obvious signs of foul play on Mr. Hurley's body. Preliminary autopsy results confirm that there doesn't appear to be any physical injuries on Williams' body. Investigators are awaiting toxicology results to determine the specifics. Although preliminary results showed no trauma to his body, investigators are waiting on the tox report to see if William consumed alcohol or any other substances. Results will take up to 3 weeks." Brendan Vendi, the friend who attended the game with William Hurley, said he hadn't drank that much. You know, so and actually, to reiterate what you had mentioned earlier today, in the episode, Claire Mahoney also said he sounded fine on the phone, you know, during their conversation. But he did actually mention that he was tired. So
So a lot, obviously there are some points in there that are suspicious, and even more so when we get into the details. But like you said, he was in the, he said that his body was in the water just a couple of days when he was missing for six. How does that make sense to you?
It doesn't to me. It doesn't at all.
Yeah. And they said that they indicated that there was no indication of any physical injuries on his body. You know, obviously this was preliminary, but when you actually get into more details of this case, you know, you see that is also an oversight that they missed. There was obviously something else going on there. But regardless, the toxicology report came back and it indicated that Will's blood alcohol level concentration was low, indicative that this would mean he wasn't inebriated. However, the report showed that Will did have GHB in his system, the date rape drug. You know, we covered in previous episodes, this seems to be a common denominator in these cases. You know, the GHB in his system was reported to have been 18 micrograms, which is well above the normal level of GHB that a human being produces naturally. Again, you also have to wonder, why did the medical examiner decide to test for GHB in his system? That's not standard procedure. Are they suspecting that there was some sort of foul play when they ran the tox report?
And that just kind of goes back to, you know, both district attorneys saying, oh, no foul play at all here. You know, this is just your classic, you know, classic drowning case. Like, we have no evidence to support that. But why are you ordering a report for, you know, a toxicology report for GHB?
Yeah, like I said, it's not standard procedure to get GHB tox report.
Yeah.
You know, it. And being that the fact that they did find an elevated level of GHB in the system, mm-hmm. did Will admit, did they think he took this GHB on his own accord to watch a hockey game?
I mean, you know, I can't speak for him, unfortunately, but I mean, I just know that in my own personal preference, I wouldn't.
Yeah. That didn't make a whole lot of sense to me, but I mean, I don't want to like just kind of linger on this because obviously it's frustrating. It doesn't make a whole lot of sense to me. Maybe they had another reason why they disregarded that, but you know, further investigation of the body, you know, the more they gave details of the autopsy, they revealed that Will actually had suffered blunt force trauma to the head, eye socket, and behind his leg. It was observed that the location where his body was found, there were no fences or barriers surrounding the water's edge. And surveillance footage from outside the stadium captures Will stumbling and struggling to maintain his balance. Was this because the GHB in his system was starting to take effect?
Yeah, I mean, it very well could be. I mean, because if he didn't have, you know, any sort of alcohol in his system, it's very well possible that could be the case.
Yeah, and given the intoxication Will appeared to have been in, revealed by the footage, the lack of barriers near the water, the fact that it was only a 5-minute walking distance from his last known call to the river, the police put a theory forward that said that an intoxicated William Hurley walked from the stadium's parking lot on 99 Nashua Street to the river's edge, and he ultimately fell into the water. The case was closed and labeled as an undetermined drowning.
Yeah, and that's, I mean, just looking at our last case, you know, for Luke, you know, they just automatically just kind of assumed that this was going to be, or that this was an accidental drowning, you know, but there was so much more evidence that kind of slipped through the cracks, you know, to really kind of nail that case down, and it didn't, you know?
Yeah.
So
I don't know.
You know, which kind of leads me to our next point here. You know, did the police really have no suspicion of foul play in this case? You know, maybe it was because of the large number of bodies recovered in the Charles River, you know, throughout that time period. A popular location where suicides occur, genuine cases of inebriated individuals falling in and drowning. You know, so the Charles River is not necessarily foreign to, obviously, this sort of situation.
No,
but
you get, you know, it a lot.
Yeah, we absolutely do. But yeah, we have to consider that, you know, Boston's a city of 600,000 people strong, you know, one of the world's highest concentration of college students. It's a city surrounded by water on many sides. You know, a simple Google search of the Charles River is going to show, you know, exactly how many missing person cases the local police department deals with on an annualized basis. You know, a lot of these cases end up being a suicide or even accidental drowning. You know, so I can definitely see from that perspective, you know, why they would just immediately just go into, yep, accidental drowning, that's it. But there are so many factors at play here that raise red flags.
Exactly. And I mean, I get what you're saying. And as you're just trying to be devil's advocate, trying to see it from the police's point of view. Because like you said, if you Google drownings in the Charles River, you get a ton of cases. And they get inundated with cases of people falling in the river. And like you said, a lot of these are actual suicides, accidental drownings even. You know, a lot of homeless people have fallen into this river, has been recorded. But when you look at the evidence in this case, even with the information that was released initially, I just don't see how this case wasn't followed up on, you know, how they just dismissed it as, and you know, it wasn't labeled an accidental drowning, mind you, it was labeled as an undetermined drowning. So they know he drowned. They're not really sure how he drowned.
Which definitely, you know, poses some questions, you know, I mean, again, just kind of circling back to what we were literally just talking about.
Yeah. So, you know, the case was dismissed, you know, open and shut drowning case. Obviously, Wool's family were devastated because, I mean, that just didn't make a whole lot of sense to them. But fast forward some years later, you know, retired detectives Gannon and Duarte, who are the proponents of the smiley face theory, they kind of begin investigating Will's case, and they're hoping to bring forth some evidence to reopen the case as a potential homicide. So they gather autopsy reports, toxicology reports, the crime scene photographs, and they begin interviewing those people who were closest to Will.
So Gannon and Dr. Gilbertson actually met with forensic toxicologist Sabra Botch Jones to discuss the role GHB might have determined Will's fate that night. The toxicologist, Botch Jones, stated, and I quote, "We all naturally have a certain level of GHB in our bodies at any given point in time, but it can also be administered as a drug. We typically use a cutoff of about 10 micrograms per milliliter for GHB to distinguish between natural GHB levels and administration of the drug," end quote. So with Will's toxic report, you know, revealing that his GHB levels were recorded to be at 18 micrograms, and after reviewing the surveillance footage of Will outside the garden, which you can clearly see, you know, that his motor functions are very impaired, Botch Jones actually said he is under the influence of an impairing substance. So that's going to either tell us Will administered himself with GHB, or someone unbeknownst to him slipped it into his drink in order to drug him. So it was actually reported that Will had some alcoholic beverages while at the Bruins game. Did anybody at the game see him do this? You know, the person who sold him the drink? I mean, was it the other individual who was there with him that night? You know, did they have something to do with it? Will actually text his girlfriend Claire that he did not like this guy. You know, so kind of poses, you know, a lot of questions, you know, kind of circling this. You know, Boston PD actually followed that lead and stated that they questioned the individual and cleared him of any suspicion.
Yeah, and we'll... The phone records, we'll get into that in a little bit later, but, you know, throughout, you know, when he got to the game, as we mentioned that he was texting Claire while he was there, he mentioned a few times that he really didn't like that guy. It was a mutual friend of his buddy, you know, but he said that the guy, I believe he said he was a tool, that he really didn't like him, that he wants to kill this dude. So maybe he was just an obnoxious person, you know, Will genuinely didn't like him. I don't know, would this guy have something to do with it? But like you just said, you know, Boston PD supposedly looked into it. They questioned him and they cleared him of any suspicion.
Yeah, so Gannon and Duarte were actually able to obtain the damaged cell phone that we actually mentioned earlier on in the episode, because they had actually believed that it had been run over by a passing car because of the way it was smashed. So the investigators brought the phone to digital forensic analyst Derek Ellington for testing. Ellington had noted that there was an excessive damage to the cell phone's hinge. Will's phone at the time was a flip phone with an accessible physical keyboard. Ellington states, and I quote, "When a phone is run over, you don't see that much damage, maybe a cracked screen," end quote. A phone that is ran over by a tire would actually, it would squish or kind of deform slightly, you know, but when somebody actually wants to destroy a phone, it's always take the battery out, discard it, and then when they do what they call a twist and they separate it. You know, so I mean, like, think about anything else that you want to kind of break. You kind of, you know, make a twisting motion with it, you know?
Yeah, and like you said, it was it's one of these flip phones that, you know, has an actual physical keyboard on it.
Right.
And, you know, you'll get into more details of, you know, how the phone itself was found.
Yeah. So if you go twist it, you're going to get a lot of torque and resistance from the first hinge. But the second hinge pops pretty easily. So Ellington actually noted that there was a significant amount of scuffing and scratching that would be consistent with the cell phone having been run over after, you know, it was all broken up and everything. So the investigators believe this assessment of the phone could support the theory that some type of human intervention was involved in the night Will went missing. So Ellington was able to retrieve data from Will's phone that was dormant for over 9 years at this point. They recovered the text conversation Will had with his girlfriend Claire the night he disappeared. Some of the text messages showed disdain towards the other individual he was with, much like you just noted, saying, and I quote, "I don't like this kid, such a tool, I'm going to kill him." According to the text messages, he seemed pretty agitated before leaving the arena. But according to the police report, there was never an altercation.
Yeah.
Again, police did question this individual and cleared him of any suspicion back in 2009, just to make that very clear.
Yeah. And even more so, the phone battery from Will's phone was never recovered. And his phone was recovered a short distance from where he was made, from where he made that last phone call to his girlfriend, Claire. And it was just probably like 20 yards, 25 yards away from where he supposedly made that call by the guard shack.
Yeah, not very far.
Yeah, so like you said, the guy was cleared of any suspicions, but, you know, he obviously left the game early. Well, one, because he probably wasn't a big fan of the game, but maybe this guy had a bigger part in him leaving. But this still leads us to question, you know, his phone, originally they suspected it was kind of driven over by a vehicle, a car that smashed it. But like this expert said, that it looked like someone took the battery out, twisted and separated the phone, you know, to intentionally break it and then tossed it. So, you know, how would you think that happened? You know, if Will dropped his phone, then that would have been indicative that it just got ran over. But this was obviously some sort of human intervention. Did Will do this to his phone because it died? You know, took the battery out and tossed it? I don't know about you, but I don't typically destroy my phone when my battery dies.
Yeah, no, I completely agree there. And, you know, it definitely does, you know, kind of lead you to kind of believe that, you know, that there was some sort of altercation, you know, or at least some sort of intervention, like you said, you know, mm-hmm. to basically lead into, you know, somebody destroyed his phone or something happened. They destroyed his phone because they don't want anyone to recover, you know, obviously where this guy is, or, you know, they just want to say, you know, they don't want anyone to find him or at least give them time to kind of, I guess, move on and get away.
Yeah. So, I mean, you've got the fact that the phone was destroyed by human interaction. You've got the fact that Will had elevated levels of GHB in his system. So did GHB get administered to him at the game? Was it before the game, before they got there? I just don't understand how he was able to get elevated levels of GHB. You know, it must have been administered at some point before he left the arena. I'm just having a hard time picturing where exactly that happened.
I mean, it definitely poses a lot of questions, like I said. I mean, you know, there's so many different, you know, theories and you know, routes that we can kind of take this. But, you know, at this point of the game, I mean, it's a big mystery, you know.
Yeah. But even moving on from that, I guess, like I said, I don't want to linger too much on that because obviously we might never know. It's just, it's interesting to think about that, you know, police didn't think there was something more there, but a retired Boston police officer named Joe Fisher, he reached out to Gannon and Duarte, and he told them that he actually had encountered multiple smiley faces near the river's edge, where he believes these can be linked to almost a dozen drowning cases in that area. So Fisher explained that in 2015, he found the first smiley face symbol located on an electrical box by the Boston Harbor. And he even went on to mention that he saw a smiley face with three stars above it. And I quote, "And it occurs to me that at the point that three victims had gone missing into the Boston Harbor. Smiley face, three stars, three victims recovered by the Boston police," end quote. So let's go back to episode 9, where we talked about how common smiley face symbols are, you know, where crime expert Michael Arnfield, who, along with his students, you know, they conducted that research, which concluded that smiley face was the most common non-gang graffiti tag in the U.S. national database. So was this common street tag graffiti, or was it actually a symbol to taunt the police, like this retired police officer, Joe Fisher, states?
Yeah, I mean, and it's plausible, you know, because you think about that. It's just very, it's very coincidental that there's a smiley face with three stars above it, three victims that are recovered. You know, that to me is very peculiar, but, you know, I don't want to necessarily assume, you know, because that's not what we're here to do. But mm-hmm. at the same time, it is very coincidental, you know. But, yeah. you know, Fisher actually stated that he searched the area surrounding 99 Nashua Street, the last known location of Will, and discovered a second smiley face had been spray painted on a slab of concrete. So Gannon and Dr. Gilbertson sought the help of forensic pathologist Dr. Elizabeth LaPasada. LaPasada, that's a fun name.
Yeah, it's kind of underwater. Hard to say.
That's a mouthful. Yeah, that sure is. An underwater forensic investigator, Rhonda Moniz, about William's facial injuries and his body discovery site. So Dr. LaPasada, that really is a mouthful, contended that the bruising on the side of his nose and under his right eye could not have been the result of falling into the river. And I quote, "When someone falls, they hit the bony prominences. So they hit their chin, they hit the tip of their nose, they hit their cheekbones. They don't hit the recessed area here or here," and they're pointing at the nose and under the eye.
Yeah. So, I mean, obviously, that's very interesting. You know, so she went on to say that Will's wounds could not have been inflicted post-mortem after death, as police had theorized. You know, to have a, and I quote, this is from her, "to have a really fully developed contusion, as Mr. Hurley had, you would have had to have your heart pumping," end quote. So due to the nature of Will's bruising, the doctor determined that he had sustained those injuries just minutes before the contusion appeared. So I quote, "it would be something around the event of his death, and if someone punched him and he fell in, that's a homicide," end quote. So obviously this is telling us some sort of foul play must have occurred, because she's saying this bruising to his face happened before he died. Not like police had theorized that he fell in and the bruising was resulted, mm-hmm. you know, after some point after he drowned.
Well, I mean, think about that real quick. You know, so if he died, you know, and, you know, ultimately fell into the river, you know, he's not going to have any contusions. You know, the blood stops pumping. You know, blood sends, or your body sends blood to an area that gets hit or something like that, you know, to help heal, right?
Yeah.
So if you're dead, your heart's not pumping blood, you're not going to get any blood to, you know, a spot where you would ultimately get hit.
Yeah, and I mean, also, it's possible that you fall in and, you know, you hit something inside the river, you hit the bottom, you hit a rock, it's possible. But then, you know, she states, and she's very explicit about the fact that his wounds are in the recessed part of his face. If he would have actually hit something in the river, a rock or something like that, you know, it would have been his nose, you know, his forehead, his chin. But that wasn't the case. This was like in his eye socket, you know, it was in the recessed parts of his face, that the only way you could reach it is like if somebody would actually hit you with a blunt object.
Mm-hmm. Very, which is very interesting.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, which kind of leads to our next question, you know, did he get into an altercation with someone outside the arena? And if so, why hit him if he was under the effects of GHB, you know? Was the robbery gone wrong, or did something else, you know, kind of spur this?
Right, and the fact that, you know, his wallet was intact would tell you that this wasn't an actual robbery unless, you know, something happened and he fell in the river, but that doesn't make a whole lot of sense to me.
Yeah.
It seems like this, you know, Will was grabbed after he was drugged and he was beaten and ultimately discarded in the river. That's what it looks like to me.
Yeah, and it's very hard to kind of differentiate that, you know, and kind of speculate something different, you know, but that is ultimately what it kind of seems like.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so another detail in the case that Gannon and Duarte found suspicious was actually the location where Will's remains are found. They stated that it would be impossible for Will to enter the water near Nashua Street because his body was found upstream of the location. So, you know, if we go by the police theory, when Will fell into the water on Nashua Street, you know, he would have floated upstream to where his body was ultimately found. You know, so how does the body float upstream? You also got to note that the area he was found was previously searched by the Massachusetts State Police dive team and the Boston Police dive team. Did they just miss him that first time around? You know, they informed Will's girlfriend, Claire, that he was not in the water. And then 8 hours later, they found his body in that same area, upstream, where they supposedly he fell in.
Yeah, which is very peculiar. But, you know, much like, you know, some of these other cases that we've covered, you know, on land, you know, primarily, you know, that Dave Politis has actually touched on, you know, there are actually, you know, cases where, you know, searchers go out there and they scour these areas. But then ultimately, you know, the person's remains show up hours later, you know, just miraculously and mysteriously, you know.
Yeah, in places that are already searched.
Exactly. You know, yeah, so yeah. It's kind of one of those phenomenons that is just kind of more common in these types of cases.
Yeah, and I don't want to say it's impossible that, you know, you search an area, you don't find anybody. But, like, I granted, you know, we're human beings. You know, it was in the river. It's possible they could have missed him. My biggest problem with that is that he's found upstream of where they said he fell in. That doesn't make sense to me. How does a body float upstream?
Yeah.
So I mean, going into that point, underwater forensic investigator Rhonda Moniz said, and I quote, "The interesting thing is that the Charles River current flows northeasterly. And he was found on the opposite direction up the Charles River before 99 Nashua Street, which would have been against the current. There's no way that a body is going to go against the current," end quote, like I just mentioned. You know, the only way a body would float against the current if a strong enough winds would push that body upstream. So, you know, they actually went out there to the Charles River, to that exact location, and they performed an experiment. And you can find this, you know, I was going to mention at the end of the episode. If you'd like to know more about this case, they actually did an episode, the investigators did, Gannon, Duarte, Dr. Gilbertson, on oxygen. And we'll get into more details of that. But they show you an experiment they did where they went out there. They actually put Dr. Gilbertson in the water, and they researched the wind patterns on the day that Will supposedly fell in the river. And they went out on a similar day. So the wind patterns were very similar on this day that they did their experiment. So they put Dr. Gilbertson in the water, the same area where supposedly Will fell in. And he lays in that water and he just quickly starts flowing downstream, the opposite direction where they found his body. So it obviously, you know, that poses a lot of questions.
I mean, I would say.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, given Rhonda Muniz's title, her credibility, you know, it adds even more question marks to the case. You know, Will's cause of death was determined to be a drowning, according to the examiner, but also we got to look at the fact that the matter of drowning was undetermined in the autopsy report. So
yeah,
there's just a lot of variables here that, you know, just don't add up.
Yeah, I mean, Gannon and Dr. Gilbertson actually concluded that William must have entered the river much farther upstream, or perhaps, you know, the body was dumped in the water 10 to 15 minutes before it was actually discovered. You know, so he wasn't in the river, you know, as long as people kind of had speculated.
Yeah, so that would tell you that there was human intervention or something else dumped him right before his body was found. There's just, I have no way of knowing, I have no idea, but it's just, to me, it seems like police had way more leads to follow.
Yeah, and I mean, kind of going back to the Luke Homan case, I mean, there were plenty of missed opportunities and dropped balls over there on that particular case. And, you know, this one, again, you know, there's just very peculiar, you know, facts, or, you know, facts that point to possible evidence to be found. And there's a lot missing that, you know, honestly, like, it could have been a case breaker. I mean, they might have been able to find out who actually did this if they pursued, you know, maybe even a couple of the leads.
Yeah, so, like, let's kind of summarize, you know, the William Hurley's disappearance and death, you know, they're shrouded in perplexing circumstances. So some questions that I have, you know, how did Will get the GHB in his system? Why did he have blunt force trauma to his face, you know, falling into the river, or did someone purposefully inflict that damage to him? The fact that his intact wallet was found on his body would tell us that this wasn't just a petty robbery. There was no sign of sexual assault reported. So those are just a few questions I had after looking at all these details. It's hard to pinpoint these to me.
Yeah, but it's also important to you know, kind of denote the clustering of drowning victims in that particular area. From 2007 to 2016, 10 men between the ages of 18 to 26 have gone missing in that general vicinity.
Yeah.
That's a pretty, vast number, of younger guys, that are their lives are just being cut short.
Yeah, and I mean, like I said,
Mysteriously, might I add.
the Charles River is known to have a lot of drownings, and maybe that's why it was so easily dismissed as an undetermined drowning. I just don't think that was the case. But if you, like I said earlier, if you want to find out more information on William Hurley's case and the investigation from the detectives, Oxygen actually has a TV series called Smiley Face Killers: The Hunt for Justice. And the show documents the team of Gannon, Duarte, Dr. Gilbertson investigating cases of these young men, who unfortunately had their time cut short on this earth. You can also go on oxygen.com and read their blogs on these cases. Some of them are very interesting, including William Hurley's. We'll link all that info in the show notes so you guys can check it out if you're interested.
Yeah, and hopefully Will's, case can be reopened by authorities, and maybe then they can kind of provide some more answers, or at least find more answers. Our sincerest condolences to, to Will's family and friends, and hopefully they can get some closure in the future.
Yeah, and before we wrap this up, I did find that the Boston Police Department actually grabbed the phone records that Duarte and Gannon actually recovered. So, maybe potentially this tells us that they're gonna look into the case further. Hopefully they reopen it. But if we get any more an update on that case, we'll bring it up in future episodes and in our social media, or we'll bring it up in a bonus episode. But
Yeah,
like you
no,
said,
for sure.
condolences to William Hurley's family. Hopefully someday they'll get some closure. This one has definitely, it tells me that there's more than it meets the eye on this case. It's something definitely happened to Will that night.
But if you, kind of wrapping up here because we are running out of time, if you do like the podcast, make sure you like and subscribe wherever you listen from. If you're listening on Apple Podcasts, which our statistics show that 54% of you guys do, please make sure to leave us a review. They actually help us tremendously in promoting the show and kind of getting it out there and everything. And it also kind of lets us know how we're doing, as hosts of the podcast and everything. So those reviews and that feedback, really does help us out.
Yeah, they help a lot. And if you have anything to add to our discussion, if we missed anything important, we apologize, but feel free to email us. Email us at thewildlyunexplained@gmail.com. We're happy to take any suggestions, any future episode suggestions. We like talking to you guys. You can find us on our social media, Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, YouTube. We're pretty active on there. We love talking to you guys. I mean, you can tell them a little bit more about our Patreon, Gary.
Yeah, so I mean, if you haven't yet, consider joining our Patreon. We actually have a community Discord that we have. We've set it up for you guys, and where we kind of discuss, previous and future episodes with all you guys in there. And you actually also get access to our bonus content, through our Patreon. So typically speaking, those are half an hour long segments, where we just kind of, Dan and I kind of go in there with an open mind and just kind of, talk about some of the more adverse stuff that we don't talk about in our, daily podcasts. So right now you can sign up for that. It's $2.50 a month. And again, you get all the bonus content, the Discord, access to us, kind of, if you ever want to chat or anything like that. And if not, we appreciate you guys listening to the podcast either way.
Yeah, so if you would like to hear Gary and I talking about some other stuff, we the gloves come off for a bonus episode. We really get into some more fringe topics. So if that sounds interesting to you and you'd like to hear a little bit more about us, consider taking that pledge. Find us on patreon.com backslash the wildly unexplained. And is there anything I'm forgetting, Gary? You want to maybe our
Yeah,
sponsor?
I do want to actually touch on the Bearded Bean Coffee Company. That is actually one of our partners that we in the recent weeks have actually partnered up with. Really, really great company. It's basically farm to table coffee. What you can do is you can go onto their website, order a cup or order a bag of coffee. Excuse me, not a cup. And they'll actually get it to your house within a couple days, and it is incredibly quality quality stuff.
It's delicious.
Danny and I actually ordered Guatemalan blend or Guatemalan roast coffee, and it is phenomenal. I actually have a cup of coffee every morning before work, and sometimes I'll even make another one to bring to work. But it is quality stuff. And we actually do have a 15% discount code for y'all. That is going to be Wildly, and you can use that on the Bearded Bean Coffee Company website. Again, that code is going to be Wildly, Wildly, and that gives you a 15% discount off of anything on the website there. That could be coffee, merch, you can buy mugs, you can, you know, whatever you want to get on there. And hey, maybe if you tweeted them enough, they'll actually make a Wildly Unexplained blend. So, you know, that's something we can kind of try to get into motion for you guys.
Yeah, we'll see what happens. You know, the Bearded Bean Coffee Company, check them out. It's delicious. But, you know, this was a fun episode. Let's see what we got for you guys next week.
Yes, sir. Checking off.
See you later, bro.